But yet still, prisons, there was people locked up, there was Africans locked up, there was a lot of brothers and sisters locked up. But it changes, right? In the States, around late 40s, early 50s, right? The civil rights movement is like coming into that full bloom. You know, it's been a lot of different smaller movements happening in the South, material support from Northerners, and by the time you reach the early to mid 50s, people aren't quite yet screaming Black Power, but people are saying, I'm a human and I demand my rights. Things started to get a little funky around that time. So as the government usually does, even though people were more, they weren't demanding yet, they were still kind of asking, right? People were marching, they were asking for concessions, you know? But that still wasn't acceptable, right? So what does the government do? It goes in and quelches all the dissent of people asking. I'm sure you've maybe seen the footage, the old black and white footage, the hoses, the dogs, just the beatings of every, you know, women, children, whoever was out on the block. Now, with that happening, more people get arrested. They find new ways to criminalize people. So now, dissent, what used to be a legal form of dissent, right, starts to become criminalized, not on the books, but in terms of how the law becomes applied. Now, the civil rights movement, in terms of how fast it changed from civil rights movement to the Black Power movement, it happened in less than a decade because of the conditions that the state was imposing on people, right? So it went from asking that I'm a human to saying no, you know, I demand that this is what you give us. I demand an end to this. I demand an end to this. We want this. We want this. So you went from asking in a kind of argumentative tone, right, to demanding in a very confrontational, militant tone around the late 60s. Now, around the late 60s, early 70s, was it the same here, right? You had the FLQ, was that the group that was doing the kidnappings and the bombings and all this? Similar, the same thing was going on in the States. You had what happened to the Panthers, which they split into a militant group called the Black Liberation Army. You had the George Jackson Brigade on the West Coast. You had the Ohio Seven. You had the Weather Underground. So all of a sudden, this movement of asking and kind of, you know, having a debate and dialogue with the empire, oppressor, whatever you like to call those folks at the top, all of a sudden changed to this very, very, very militant stance. And the government got really scared and got really shook because they honestly did not know what direction things were going to go. So, out of that time, there had already been a program the government had been working on. It had been very effective. It had effectively dealt with the American Indian movement, the New Left, the student movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the Black Panther Party, and that's called COINTELPRO. Have you guys heard of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program? Yeah. So while that was going on, again, all of a sudden new ways to criminalize people are coming up, right? You have influx of heroin, so like she's saying, it's easy. You've got an activist who has a little H, all of a sudden, boom, you get them in a buy and bust, they're locked up for 5 years. You have people that now, because that maybe primary breadwinner is locked up for the heroin, now the moms have to go out and maybe do sex work, maybe they're stealing, the moms get locked up. The kid goes into foster care, now the kid is in the state supervision, the kid's out of 16, she's out of 16, not much direction, not much access to family resources, fuck it, I'm gonna rob too. So you see, as this was all pushing forward, as you went from Africans being freed to what I'm gonna get to right about now, it was always this push that was kind of shadowing the path of the course of history, was that how are we going to get all these folks back under our servitude without calling them slaves? And that's why I brought up the 13th Amendment earlier. Does anybody know, in the United States, how many people are locked up in prison? Besides anyone on the panel. Take a guess, how many people? First of all, how many people locked up in Canada, you know?
It's a lot less.
Like 100,000, 140,000, right? 120,000. 40,000. That's in the
provincial really. End. 40,000 to 50,000.
So okay, that's about it, right? 50,000 people in Canada are locked up. What's the population of Canada? You know, 22 million. All right. Anyone know how many people locked up in the States? Take a guess. There's no wrong answer.
2 million.
Yeah, there's over 2 million people. There's about 2.3 million people locked up in America. which basically roughly translates to about one in every 110, 120 people in America is in prison. Right? As you start looking at the like at the racial and class dichotomy of it, you start to see that in neighborhoods where you have black and Latino people, the percentage goes much higher, sometimes 33, 35, 40%. In New York, just alone, we have primarily all the people in New York upstate prisons only come from seven neighborhoods in New York. Only seven neighborhoods feed the, all the prisons in upstate, you know. So, to try and to bring this back here, today, you know, in Brooklyn, what exists is something very similar to those times right around the Emancipation Proclamation with the black codes and, you know, prior to Jim Crow. In the sense that the militarized presence in New York right now, in terms of the police force, it gets more funding than any other social program, you know? In a neighborhood that's a feeder neighborhood, one of those seven neighborhoods, for example, East New York, they funded, I think, $1.5 million into this neighborhood that was already supplying a majority of people into prison. They split a precinct, a police precinct into three precincts, gave 150 more cops, and said, look, you know, this is a, we need to, you know, we need to get tough on crime again. So what that leaves you with is a population of people, like she's saying, that becomes invisible, right? It becomes faceless. And so because of that, their forms of resistance and their forms of how they struggle against the prison industrial complex also becomes invisible. So I just want to really speak about like a couple really amazing examples and experiences of how people do resist the prison industrial complex in their own way, in a way that maybe we don't recognize and maybe we don't see, maybe we don't acknowledge, we don't share that experience, therefore sometimes it does become invisible to us. So, you know, one thing that I've always talked about a lot in terms of where people get the time or energy to do to come to conferences, to be organizers, to be activists, to be militants, revolutionaries, whatever you want to call it, you know, a lot of it, not most of it, but some of it has to do with different kinds of privilege we all have, right? So in Brooklyn, one really great way that these women, all women of color, have been dealing with it is they formed a community cooperative childcare network, right? A lot of the women in this neighborhood, Bushwick, which is a primary Latino neighborhood, you know, might work more than one job, have more than one child, and also not have immigration status, you know, might have a lot of things stacked up against them. So to ask them to come to a meeting, to a conference, to come be an organizer, when they're dealing with just really concrete shit in their life that they need to struggle with, you know, to me there's a certain maybe arrogance involved in that. As opposed to saying, well, you know, we really want you to come through, we want your input, we want your direction, I know you got to deal with your kids, I know you got two jobs, but just come on, just find some time. So what these women did was they said, look, we're going to get together, ask people that are our comrades, our allies for resources, and we're going to watch out for each other's kids. So you can have some time. So you can have some time for yourself. So you can have some time to do the things that you need to do. The things we keep asking you to do that you never have time for because you're always watching your child and you never have anyone watch them, we're going to do that. We're going to do that for ourselves so that we can give each other those times and those privileges that that we don't have. That's just like one example I think that's really, like it shows the creativity and how people can come together and organize. One that I like to show in terms of what a lot of ways that youth resist, this is my favorite example I was telling someone the other night. In New York, I don't know if you know, but the subway costs $2 for a ride. It's like about the same here maybe. So it's $2 a ride. So that means to go to and from a place you need to spend $4. A lot of people don't got $4. How do they get by that? There's so many undercover cops in subways nowadays, like you can't hop the turnstile, you get arrested, you go to jail, it's just not worth it. So what do they decide, what do kids develop, and it's not just kids, but they definitely set it off. Somehow someone was inventive enough to figure out that if you bend the MetroCard between the A and the R in exactly the middle and form a cross, then when the machine reads it, it reads it as the fare was paid. Right? So this, my point being is that when we think of resisting, a lot of times we think of direct action or we think of campaigns. We don't think about what are people who are feeling like the ass end of oppression, right? Who are feeling the heaviest weight of oppression, how are they resisting? You know? And that's serious because mobility, the ability to move, is something that colonialism really cut off. Just like my comrade Ashanti couldn't come to Canada. You know, they said, no, you can't, this border is closed to you. The same way they're telling you, you don't have $4, no, you can't get to where you need to go. And so, inside all that statist oppression and all that capital oppression, the one thing that I really want to make sure that echoes out is that there has always been resistance. Since the first Africans were brought here, since the last subway fare hike in Brooklyn, there's always been resistance that exists. The same way that, you know, there's a lot of, right now, street tribes, gangs, right? There's a lot of gangs in Brooklyn. The most prevalent gang is the Bloods, which originally started as kind of an offshoot when the Panthers got kind of towards the latter days of the 60s and the early 70s. COINTELPRO was really coming at them all different directions. It was a splinter, east, west coast, different factions popped off. Out of that, in LA, came the Bloods and the Crips. In Brooklyn, I couldn't really say how many Bloods there are. It's definitely in the thousands. The way that they resist is another way, I think, that, and I want to kind of touch on this and kind of close out and move on. The way that they resist is one thing I want to talk about kind of in the dialogue is, they replicate really awful things, right? From patriarchy to hierarchy, and all the things that are inside us, the internal shit in us. But at the same way, their resistance does not come from an intellectual, abstract, this sounds really good, I'll feel better about myself, I could deal with some of my guilt, you know, way. It's distinctly, and it comes from a very clear survival necessity. It comes from the need of survival. Why organize in a large group in a neighborhood where the police are constantly attacking you, where they're constantly snatching you up to prison? Now, if you create an area in your neighborhood where the police can't go, that creates a new kind of space.